Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Empty Promise Podcast. My name is Chris, and today I am joined on this beautiful Sunday morning by my best friend in the whole wide world, Mr. James D. Downey.
Why, hello.
D, thank you for joining me on, like I said, this beautifully fresh Sunday morning. It is the 21st of February. It's nearly gone, D.
I know. It's the beginning of the end of February, the last week of February.
Just the beginning of the end, yeah.
Of February.
We are about to roll into spring, D. Like, just swoop in, you know? And from the looks of things, like, if it stays this way, we're going to come in like a lamb.
Out like a lion.
Out like a lion. Like,
well, that's not what you want to hear, especially.
No. I'd rather come in like a lion.
The year we're having.
Well, I know. Although, yeah, I guess none of us could have foreseen last year either, like, you know, saying that.
That's why
we probably threw that phrase out.
I can only see things getting worse at the minute. Okay. I don't know. Mm. At least we'll get a good couple of weeks, hopefully. God only knows.
Exactly. Like, I know.
It could be snowing in March, like.
It probably could. Like, I mean, look at the weather we had last week. Like, it was crazy.
Exactly.
But yes, thank you for joining me, D. It is our 122nd episode.
Hmm.
And to mark it, we're going to do the exact same thing we do every week. And that is, I am going to tell you, D, a little bit about what happened on this day somewhere in history. In 1916, World War One, the Battle of Verdun begins with a German offensive. It leads to an estimated 1 million casualties and becomes the longest battle of the entire World War One.
My God.
It lasted 9 months. Imagine a single battle. Lasting 9 months, Steve.
Like, whenever I remember learning about World War One in school, and them talking about a war happening for 4 years or 5 years,
yeah.
And I was like I couldn't comprehend. I was like,
no,
battles and wars happen like in a day. That's what my understanding.
Yeah,
is. You have a fight,
exactly.
There's a winner and there's a loser. But this is like this lasted for 4 years and lasted 9 months. Like, holy shit.
Yeah, because like when we were in high school and stuff, when we learned like, you know, like the Battle of Hastings and stuff, them battles were like battles that maybe lasted a day into 2 days.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it was over. There was a winner and there was a loser. But these went on for like years, which is absolutely insane.
That 9 months, right? That 9 months is probably 80% of that was probably just like, man sitting in trenches waiting for bombs to fall on their head.
It's the waiting.
Yeah, the other 10% is like actually like fight, like what we would imagine a war to be, like fighting with guns and, you know, pushing forward and all that shit.
That's definitely where that saying comes from. You know, it's the waiting. I think that's the saying. You know, well, people talk about, you know.
If it doesn't come from there, it's definitely applicable.
Ooh.
I can speak from experience, of course.
Oh, definitely. But that's like the war starting now and not finishing to like nearly November. Like October.
You know what it's like? Insane. It's kind of a little bit like the whole COVID thing. Because like, didn't they say with World War One, they were like, I don't know, when it kicked off in like maybe October time, and they were like, oh, it'll be over by Christmas.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, people just want things not to be bad. So they kind of
believe
that. The same with COVID. It'll all fade out in the summer. Don't worry about it. We're like, here we are a year later.
Yeah. In 1990, the Batman theme composed by Danny Elfman wins the Grammy Award for Best Instrumental Composition. Do you know the Batman theme?
I know it vaguely, yeah.
I think I know it vaguely. I'm not too familiar with the Batman theme.
I couldn't just start reciting it for you, but you know, I definitely, if I heard it, I'd be like, oh yeah, that's Batman for sure.
Mm-hmm. And in 1931, the Chicago White Sox and the New York Giants play the first exhibition night game. So that was like the first that they ever played. I'm assuming the first teams ever played against each other.
No, is it not under floodlights? Is that not what a night match is?
Oh, exhibition night game. Oh yeah, okay. That makes more sense now. Yeah, yeah, okay.
I remember reading about that. There's some, I forget what game it is, but some soccer match was the first match under floodlights as well. It was always like a common...
Yeah.
Quiz question that used to float about back in my quizzing days, Chris.
Today, in 1878, the world's first telephone directory was issued with 50 subscribers to it. And that was in Connecticut.
Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have some famous birthdays for you today. Today, Alan Rickman is his birthday. Jennifer Love Hewitt's birthday. She's 42 today. And Ellen, or Elliot Page, is 34 today.
That Ellen, as in Ellen from the popular TV show Ellen?
No, like, you know who Ellie was based on? Oh,
Ellen Page, right. Yeah, yeah, I get you. But, Elliot Page, but yes.
She's now transgender, so it's Elliot Page. I thought it was,
I don't know why, I just hear Ellen and I was like, is her actual Ellen name DeGeneres? Elliot, yeah. This whole time? She's just been calling herself Ellen?
No.
What a liar.
No. And tomorrow is actually George Washington's birthday, like the George Washington. So, cool. So there you go.
Don't they celebrate his birthday in America as like a holiday or something?
Do they? I know they have President's Day, but I think that's past.
Yeah, that happened already.
I'm not sure.
It just sounds like something they would do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And I would do it too. To be fair. But that's all for on this day. And before we move into our news of the week, I just want to remind you all who are listening to the podcast that there is a video version available over at youtube.com. Just search for Empty Promise Podcast. And likewise, if you are watching the video version, the audio is available on any podcast hosting service, so you can take us with you on the go.
Aren't you lucky?
Aren't you lucky is right.
Anywhere you can listen to us.
Anywhere. I would love to hear where you listen to podcasts. Some people listen to podcasts in the weirdest of settings.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
Me included.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into some news this week, D.
Alright.
Alright.
I hope you got some good news for me, Chris.
No. I have another food outrage.
So, I like this. This is kind of like a recurring... This is like our February segment. I kind of like this.
It almost has. Yeah, it's become a thing. We had the cereal last week. We had Weetabix and beans,
mm-hmm.
And we also had another one, but I can't remember what it was. But this one's it kicked off a lot of fuss only because I think of the time. So during the week we had Pancake Tuesday.
Oh yes, of course.
So a man's pancakes have sparked outrage as people say it's worse than Weetabix and beans. So a man named Mikey G shared his pancake creation on, do you know Twitter's Rate My Plate page? Do you ever look at some of them? Okay, you like, if you want a good laugh, you gotta look up Rate My Plate. Basically, people just post a picture of their food and then they just get torn to shreds over what they're eating.
Does sound entertaining.
But people were disgusted because on the plate there were two pancakes that were homemade pancakes that were made, but then were filled with tomato salsa and fish fingers.
That is,
and that's how Mikey was enjoying his pancakes. Basically, the post was simply captioned "Fish fingers wrapped in a pancake" by Mikey G. There has been uproar within the group. Most of which the users thought his filling was questionable. One person said, "I thought Weetabix and beans was the worst food combo I've ever seen, but this is far worse. This is the clear signaling of a psychopath."
He should be on a list somewhere for what he's just done.
The picture's here, and you'll see it over on our video version if you want to see it. It doesn't look good, D. It doesn't look
right.
Good.
Do you know what? Out of the ones that we've discussed, this one's one of the... I don't think it's as bad as the cereal one from last week. Definitely not.
No, we had Shreddies with orange juice and whipped cream.
Yeah, like that one is well beyond this, I think. Because at least this is like, you know, you get your hot pancakes with... tomato salsa is a bit questionable, but like, I mean, you can have beans with just tomatoes. You know, like, I can kind of see where you're coming from. And I mean, the fish fingers are just like... again, they're not right, but they're not like... It's not like he's putting ice cream... Or it's not ice cream. Pancakes sounds pretty good, actually. It's not like he's putting, like, something in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Savory pancakes are a thing. Like, savory crepes are definitely a thing. Like, mm-hmm. You know, this is real. Sure, didn't we have... We had savory crepes. Remember the day we went down to Dublin to Michael Giacchino? We met a couple of the boys and we had a nice brunch outside.
Oh,
we all had pancakes.
That's right.
Some of those were savory, you know? So it's a thing.
Oh, it's a thing, yeah. And it works.
This is just a little unusual, I think, because many people on Pancake Day or Pancake Tuesday, whatever you call it, you know, you get the classics like sugar and lemon. You get butter, Nutella, Biscoff. You know, whatever you take.
What?
But this... What?
Repeat that last part. Biscoff?
You get... you know the Biscoff? You know the biscuits Biscoff?
No.
Have you not seen these?
No.
So, this is, you know, like the little, like, square... The only way I can describe them are, like, little square rectangle biscuits that always come with, like, a tea or coffee in, like, cafes. They're always just sitting on, like, the saucer.
Oh, I can't... Yeah, they're, like, more... Yeah, I do know. They're always individually wrapped, those things.
Yes. So, they've made, like, a spread out of these things.
Oh.
And, oh, my... No, D. No, 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 no. It is divine. It is good stuff.
Okay.
I'm gonna have to find you some Biscoff.
Well, there you go. But that, I don't think that, I don't know. Well, maybe I am way behind the times. Is that like your, is that a standard today with pancakes?
I think it's a standard because it fits into a lot of people's like diets. Like, it's vegan and vegetarian. I'm pretty sure it's gluten free.
You need
it's
to get, like, onto Twitter and you need to put this up on Rate My Plate, and we will have the world decide, because I don't know.
Okay.
It sounded a little posh, you know. A little bit of Biscoff on the pancakes.
No, it's becoming a big thing, especially since there's like ice cream bars and ice cream, like, you know, like sundae places popping up all over the show. Biscoff, like drizzled on the ice cream, is becoming a very popular thing. So the spread, I think, just cashed in on it. Started putting it into a tub. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. But yeah, there you go. Mikey G. Causing people to sparked outrage. Yeah, sparked outrage. Yeah. So, another piece of news. A time, quote, time capsule house that looks, quote, looks like it was designed by Del Boy. So Del Boy from Only Fools and Horses, Del Trotter, has gone on sale. The 4-bed house in Westcliff-on-Sea. That's the name of a place, Dee. Westcliff-on-Sea. What a fantastic place name.
I like the English, like, town names that are like that. Like, you know, it's just like, we're just telling you what it is, right? It's Westcliff. Yeah. I can tell you where that is, you know? I can tell you that's at the coast, right? I like that.
On the west somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, I like getting that kind of information. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, Westcliff-on-Sea. It's gone on the market with an asking price of $600,000, and it's proving popular thanks to its incredibly dated interior. The property on Westcliff-Sea is fitting out with formica counters, orange walls, and an extremely gaudy bathroom. I guess this is one of those things, you will have to see it. It almost looks, though, D, like a 50s diner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like really old, kind of shiny, checkered tiles. It's got like the cladding roof, like the wooden cladded roof look to it. Lots of people love the time capsule property, with one fan joking, I'd buy it just for the kitchen. Maybe remove the carpet. The bathroom, though, it's Joan Collins meets Del Boy. I'm gonna get the pictures of this added to the video version of this podcast, but I think this is terrific. But $600,000, I'm not too sure I would pay. Yeah. I think that's incredibly steep.
Is this right? No, here's a serious question for you.
The bathroom is toffee brown. So that's the color we're going
for. At least it's not pink. Do you remember the pink bathrooms?
Yeah.
But here's a serious question, right? Do you think that this is genuinely just an old house that, you know, went up and kind of, you know, grew popular because look how, you know, old it looks, and not old, but like retro, I guess is the word. Or do you think this is like an extremely talented real estate company who went like, this piece of shit hasn't been updated in 50 years, right? It's not up to code, right? It's got poor insulation. It's going to cost a bomb to get it up done. We're not going to make much money off this. But you could probably get some people who are into it because it's kind of retro. And then they're kind of like...
You know what that's like?
You always cynic like, of me
you know, that. You know the Simpsons when Marge becomes a real estate agent and she's getting like the tour from like... it's like Lionel Hutz or someone. And he's like... She's like, it's very small. I would say cozy. That's exactly what this is like, you know?
Yeah.
It's quite dated. I would say retro, you know?
that's the thing.
That's
like,
what it could be like, yeah. I don't know how they work, but yeah, possibly.
I don't think I trust real estate agents enough, but maybe, yeah, it probably is genuine, I don't know. I'm just being cynical.
Well, if we want to keep with the property news, there's a 3-bedroom home on sale for $325,000 in a... Firstly, almost half the asking price of this other retro unique one, okay? But this location hides an impressive feature, okay? So this is in Gloucestershire, I don't know, for $325,000. It's a semi-detached cottage, half a mile from Tewkesbury. But what makes this ex-lockkeeper's cottage... So take that in for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Lock Keeper's Cottage, so unique, is that it's situated on its own private island.
Oh, for 300 grand. That's not even that bad for an island.
Exactly. Accessible only via a small bridge in the River Severn. It's a breathtaking property and it could be yours. Hmm. At the front of the cottage is a small garden surrounded by a low fence which overlooks the upper lodge lock. So you've got a nice big lock behind. You've got what it can only resemble a moat running around the entire place, Dee. And the only access point is a bridge, a footbridge too. It doesn't even look like you can get a car across this thing.
Oh, okay.
On the ground floor, there's a separate dining room with a fireplace and generous fitted kitchen. There's a big patio at the back. It's gorgeous. It's so much nicer. $325,000. I will have pictures of that up as well. The garden is made...
But you have to live in Gloucestershire.
Yeah, true. Well, it's available through appointment only, so if anybody wants to see it, away you go. You can go and check that one out.
Do we get a commission if someone buys it from listening to the podcast?
I mean, you can try using our discount code again, see if it works. I don't know if it will.
10% off of 300,000 is a tidy sum, you know. So.
I mean, yeah. I'd take it, man. And I had one more piece. Have you got any news for me this week?
Yeah, Chris, I got some news.
Okay,
some news.
You go ahead.
Keeping over in the island of Great Britain, mm-hmm. a little bit further north. Did you know that there is Burns Night in Scotland to celebrate?
Burns Night. Yeah, that's right. That's close to Halloween, but not quite Halloween. Is that right?
No, it was in January.
Never mind. I have no idea what Burns Night is.
But I'm impressed that you even heard of it, because I've never heard of it.
Heard of it because I used to work with a Scottish girl who once told me that they celebrate Burns Night.
Burns Night. Burns Night. Apparently it is in celebration of the poet, somebody Burns. Gosh, I can't find his name now.
Robert
Burns.
Could be.
Oh, I was hoping that you were going to tell me. It is, in fact, Robert Burns. Yeah.
No, it's not, Dee. It's not.
So, Burns Night on the 25th of January to mark the life
of... Is it actually Robert Burns?
...of poet Robert Burns. Yeah, Robert Burns. I thought, like, you just pulled that from the deep crevasses of your mind. You were like, you knew that nugget of information, you just brought it forward.
Somewhere I clearly knew that, yeah. I'm a deeply intellectual man, Dee.
It's probably all of the on the stairs, because you've probably done it
that's
before.
That's exactly what
it, you know, is. It is like,
yeah, we once covered Robert Burns' life or something. Yeah.
All that information gets locked in there somehow.
Holy smokes. I amaze myself every day, Dee.
and me, Chris. You took me along on that journey and I enjoyed it. Well, on Burns Night, this year they celebrated by doing what some thought to be impossible. They have taken
gathering
haggis, you know, the popular Scottish like national meal.
Of course,
haggis.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've taken it to space, Chris.
Is this like the way that Iceland sent like a packet of like their chicken nuggets up into orbit and then said that they were out of this world?
Exactly. It is exactly the same.
Oh, I love the way this can be done.
454 grams of haggis were launched into space on a weather balloon and soared more than 20 miles above the earth, equivalent to nearly 4 times the height of Everest. It's pretty impressive. This was organized by Simon Howie. Mr. Howie said he wanted to start the year by lifting the spirits of the general public and was thrilled to work with Stratonauts, which is apparently what you call them. to take Scotland's national dish to new heights.
Stratonauts.
Kind of the same thing. There's
a company dedicated to sending your pieces of crap into orbit. Like.
I mean, like, they'll probably make a bomb because, like...
Of course they do.
You know, it's like, we'll send it up. Yep.
Although we have to... I just want to put 100. One of our episodes on MP3 and send it up. We've officially been heard, we've been to space.
The only podcast played in space. There you go. Like, that's bragging rights, man. Until somebody copies us, or someone's probably already got us. To be fair,
100%. Like, you trying to tell me they don't listen to the podcast up in the space shuttle? Space station, sorry. Yeah. Oh, they definitely do. That's class, though. Send a sheep's stomach up into space. There you go.
Not only that, Chris. On its descent, it's believed the Haggis fell to Earth at nearly 200 miles an hour before the parachute deployed, meaning it is probably also the fastest Haggis in the world as well.
Wow.
Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive Haggis.
That is pretty impressive, yeah. Well, I'll tell you something else that's impressive. You know whenever like fast food restaurant workers speak out? About like what goes on and some of the secrets and things like that happen, you know, in fast food. That's impressive. And I have a piece of news here about such times. A McDonald's worker has spilled the truth on the restaurant's much rumored, quote, secret menu. So, you know, for years, Dave, like we've always heard about this. It's like almost like urban myth about the secret menu, but the underground menu of McDonald's, you know. You can ask for like a McGangbang, say. But no one's brave enough to just go up and order it. Like you want to order it and then, you know, put it together in the backseat of your car.
Which like we did.
Car park.
You can check out our video on YouTube.com.
Well, these are the kind of things we're talking about. But fans of McDonald's are likely to have heard rumors about the restaurant's secret menu that have been circulating for years. It includes off-menu items only known in the underground circles of Ronald McDonald's biggest fans, including creations like the Land, Sea, and Air Burger, which combines beef patties, breaded chicken, and a fillet of fish all in one bun. Many intrigued customers have never been brave enough to order from the, quote, secret menu through fear of being laughed at from the restaurant. But a former worker has now revealed the truth about it all. So, Jack, we're going to call this guy Jack, who claims to have been a crew trainer at the fast food chain between 2015 and 2019, responded to a question from a fan who wanted to know if the items really did exist. He wrote to explain that, sadly, there isn't a set menu at McDonald's, but added, it should never stop you from ordering one. He said, you have the ability to customize almost anything on the menu. Thanks to social media, I have customers ask for crazy items such as the Mega Mac or the Land, Sea, and Air Burger all the time. This isn't on our menu, nor are we trained to create these orders. So I usually ask the customer what the item consists of and what they would like to add. I usually remember these items for the next person that asks for it. He advises... Mixing McCafe items with the standard McDonald's items are the way to get the best secret menu items. Other people who have claimed to work at the chain also backed up Jack's insider knowledge, as one wrote, there's no official secret menu, but McDonald's employees know about the variations considered to be the secret menu. For example, if you order a Monster Mac, the employee would probably know what you mean. So just because the menu... doesn't say it on the board, doesn't mean that these employees haven't heard of it. It's there. You know,
but it's
you just
not
have to,
there.
It's there, but it's not there. Yeah. So you can ask for it.
Ronald, you mysterious bastard.
It's like if you ask for, like if you can get like an ice cream and they just put a little bit of ice cream into like a cup and then they can just make a hot coffee into the cup on top of it. And then you have like this weird creation of like a hot black coffee with like a big dollop of whippy ice cream in it.
Do you think they do get annoyed by it though? Where they're like, oh, you want a McGangbang, do you? Great. Or a Mega Mac. Okay. That means we have to go do a special little item just for you. Just for you. There's 20 people in the line behind you, but you want me to go
maybe
do that, do you?
Maybe.
Do you? Is that what you want? Hey, jackass.
Maybe, yeah. That's true.
I like the way the guy had to go by Jack as well. I like the way he had to go with an anonymous name for fear of Ronald's SWAT team finding him.
That's his alias, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you don't want the not the hamburger helper. Is it the hamburger robber? What do you call that guy with like the wee...
Hamburglar?
The hamburger, yeah. You don't want him out to get you.
What do you call him? Hamburger robber? You don't mess with the clown, Chris. You just don't mess with the clown.
You don't mess with Ronald or his loyal fans.
No.
Yeah. It's been a while from I've had a McDonald's, actually.
Yeah, actually. I'd like to try. I'd like to go back and reassemble the McGangbang or Lance the Inner Burger or Mega Mac or something like that.
Yeah. The Swiss Stack, remember that bad boy?
Oh, ooh. They were good.
They were good.
Them was good burgers. They were very good burgers.
Yeah. Well, that's all the news I have this week, D.
I do have one other piece of news. A man has handed himself into the police as he says he'd rather be in jail than spend any longer with the people he is at home with during lockdown. Which, I mean, I feel bad for him, but I also feel bad for the people he was being locked down with.
So he just willingly walked into a police station?
Exactly. A man wanted by police handed himself in so he wouldn't have to spend any more time in lockdown with the people he lived with. Officer said the man gave himself up on Wednesday past to get some, quote, peace and quiet.
Was he wanted by police?
Yeah, he was wanted. And he was like, I guess, on the run. I don't think he was like, you know, like a master criminal or anything like that. Maybe just like didn't show up for his hearing or something like that.
Right.
Police did not say what crime he was suspected of. But he did show he handed himself in rather than spend any longer with the people he was living with.
Wow.
Which I don't know if people who are listening to that can relate or not. Hopefully you're all having a great time locked down with your family and friends.
With your loved ones. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, some people aren't having such a good time, unfortunately.
No, I get it, yeah. But going to the police is not... It's not the answer, guys.
Actually, a little bit on this. A study released in October has found that more than half the population have said they felt angry with other people they know because of their behavior in relation to the pandemic. And a quarter of people reported having argued with friends or family about their actions amid the restrictions, with 1 in 12 no longer speaking to a friend or relative because of disagreements.
Wow.
1 in 12? That's pretty, like, I mean...
1 in 12, that's a lot. That's a lot of people, like, considering the amount of people, like, even in the UK.
And, like, not speaking, like, that's, you know, that's more than just a falling out. That's like, that's it, we're done. It's pretty mental.
That's cool, yeah. Have you got anything?
Oh, I was supposed to get Nick Cage news, wasn't I? I got it.
I was just joshing with you, Chris. I had a piece on backup in case. I always have a piece on backup.
Well, that's good.
Just in case. But it's like an old piece, so it always sits like just in my bookmarks in case I ever need it. But we'll not call upon it today.
I like the fact that you have a bookmark for Nick Cage.
However. Of course I do. Dude, it's not just a bookmark, it's a folder that's a bookmark.
We're kind of milking the whole Willy's Wonderland movie for news at this point, because it's the most relevant piece of Nick Cage news we have. But what has emerged from an interview, Chris, is something that makes me very happy. The director of that movie has come out and stated in an interview with Entertainment Weekly that Nick is into reptiles, he's into amphibians, and he's into dinosaurs. So if you didn't know about Nick Cage, now you do.
What?
Apparently he was insistent that more of the animatronic demons, or demonic animatronics, were reptilian or amphibian in nature. He says, he apparently was quoted as saying, let's make this thing an alligator, or let's make this thing a chameleon.
I love his power. Like, no, let's make this thing a T-Rex. I want to fight a T-Rex.
The best one. Let's get a turtle in here instead of a regular mammal. It's just like...
That's brilliant. Oh, wow.
That interview is actually kind of cool. There's a lot about Nick Cage getting on board the project very early and some of the decisions that they made about the movie, including getting his character not to speak, to become like a center protagonist. All things that Nick Cage backed up and helped get that movie made. because a lot of, obviously a lot of studios were just like, this looks stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you've got Nick Cage attached,
stupid. You're always going to get the bit of crazy, like, yeah.
Exactly. All of a sudden, stupid becomes very interesting.
Nick crazy.
Nick, yeah.
Cagey.
Crazy. Did you get a chance to view the infamous Willy's Wonderland?
Did not. No. Purchased it. But it's here for 30 days. I've purchased it, yeah. I haven't put it on. But it's here for the next, 21 days or whatever now? 23 days? Whatever.
The director seems to believe that it's 2021's first cult film. So
yeah, I'm hearing good things about this, D, from people who've watched it.
It's got 80-something audience approval on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
So people,
I think it's just
it.
It's just a little bit of crazy that we needed during lockdown, you know? That crazy movie. That cult-ish classic.
Well, that's you it. Know? That's our Nick Cage news for this week. The beast has been caged.
Roar. There you go. Yes, okay, that is our news this week, and now we are going to move on to our main topic. But before we do, I'd just like to say a huge thank you to everybody who finds the podcast on a weekly basis. Thank you so much. If we could ask you to do one little thing for us, and that is, if you're listening to us anywhere, we can give us a thumbs up, a rating, a liking, or leave a comment. It would help us out tremendously with the whole us being found as a podcast. That would be tremendous. We cannot thank you enough. All over the globe, people from all walks of life, all over the globe, listening to us on a weekly basis. Thank you so much. And remember, you can find us on our social media site to get in touch, either through Instagram or Twitter. They work best for us. So hope to hear from you all very, very soon. With all the ads out of the way, D, are you ready for me to tell you a little story of survival?
I am ready. My body is prepared.
Okay. Okay. So this story is about, I want to call him Jose. It could be Jose. It could also be Jose. I'm not too sure. I'm going to call him Jose. Sal. Because I want to stay consistent throughout the story. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to call him Jose Salvador Alvarenga. Mm. Okay. But we're just going to call him Jose. Or maybe Jay. Depends. Depends how I'm feeling at any given time. We're going to talk about how this man survived adrift in the ocean, D. Now, this is it's not like a feat. Like, I don't know what way to put this. Like, it's been done before. Not obviously through choice, but it's been done before. But what makes this unique is the duration. This man stayed alive adrift in the ocean for 438 days.
Fucking hell. That's over a year. What?
Yes. Okay. So, and this comes to us from SMH, which is an Australian lifestyle kind of blog. This is the only place I could find, like a full enough account or story or even interview to go along with this incredible feat. Okay, so. On November 17th, 2012, so we're quite recent, Jose Salvador Alvarenga, who was 37 years old, and Ezequiel Cordova, who was 22 at the time, set out from the small fishing village of Costa Azul on the coast of Mexico to begin a 30-hour deep-sea fishing shift. Their vessel was a 7-meter fiberglass boat containing a refrigerator-sized icebox in which to stash the planned haul of shark, sealfish, and marlin. But a violent storm began its advance from the northeast. The two men soon found themselves battling 5-meter-high waves and over 100 kilometer-per-hour winds. Within hours, both the motor on their boat and the radio had died. Their colleagues back home launched a search and rescue mission that lasted for 2 weeks, but with no avail. Alvarenga and Cordoba and their vessel appeared to have vanished into thin air. Okay. So, November 23rd, 2012. This is 6 days in. After 5 days of careening waves and screaming wind, the storm finally eased off. Miraculously, the two men's boat had not flipped over. The sea anchor off the stern had aligned the bow to the oncoming waves and allowed the men to survive day after day, bashing and crashing through incoming waves.
My God. That's like, how many days of just pure storm? Like, storm relentlessly?
Five solid days, D.
Like, that's...
You gotta be thinking, oh my God.
You gotta be thinking, like, this is it. This is over. For five days, unrelenting.
Five days, D. That's like pretty much from now until we next meet for the podcast. Just a storm that just wrecks us. Like,
that's like,
what the hell? Isn't it? Yeah. Now, however, they awoke to a freakish calm. As Alvarenga and Cordoba scanned the horizon, the lack of waves distorted their depth perception. A styrofoam block just a kilometer away could be distorted into looking like an aircraft carrier on the horizon. So they were so used to these huge waves that now this calm just completely threw them all off. Mm-hmm. Objects 30 meters deep were now magnified and distorted by the water. Like a traveler lost in a desert, the men had no certainty that they were that what they saw or heard actually even existed. Puddles of seawater sloshed at their ankles, a reminder that despite non-stop bailing, the two men had never fully emptied the boat of water. The Yamaha motor lacked cover and cord. It looked naked. Nearly all the fishing gear was floating in the sea kilometers away, and their foul communications gear now lay at the bottom of the ocean. Taking stock of their tools and supplies was disturbingly quick. They had a long wooden plank, one grey bucket with some clothes, a battered fishing knife with a cracked handle, a trusty machete, a wooden club, the empty icebox with lid, a pile of bleach bottles, a small pile of nylon rope, the useless motor, and one red onion found wedged under a seat after the five-day tumult.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That onion's going to have to go a long way.
Yeah. Time was increasingly elastic in this world without clocks or calendars. So could you imagine that as well? Like, not having a clock or any way of telling the time. Could you imagine, like, how long each day would seem and how long each night would be?
Definitely. Because, like, you no longer have any reference to time other than the sun in the sky. So it's like, particularly when you come from, like, being in our world where you, like, literally every second of every day, you know, you look at your phone, you look at your watch or whatever, you just know immediately. So, like, having zero indication, that would just be, like, so... It would just throw you so much.
Yeah. As the morning sunlight comforted and warmed them, the fishermen hoisted the 2-meter-long wooden plank from the floor, laid it across two benches that crossed the boat like central ribs, and prepared a bed. The men stripped off their wet clothes, clad only in underwear, stretched out to sop up the first glints of sunlight. They collapsed into a deep sleep. They awoke, however, with a painful thirst. Coconuts were everywhere, and the floating fruit tortured Alvarenga. He could see them swirl by, could almost taste the chill coconut water. He spotted a solitary bobbing sphere, then an entire clutch of coconuts, like huge grapes, drifted near and lured him, dared him to swim out. Alvarenga, however, was not tempted. He knew the risks, even if he didn't actually see the fins of the patrolling sharks.
Shit.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was going to be currents or something like that, but yeah, no, it's sharks.
Sharks and probably just the complete fatigue and weakness of the men after 5 days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If they'd had either a sail or pair of oars, the men could have set a course, but lacking the tools, they drifted at the whim of the wind and the ocean currents, swerving, looping, and zigzagging across the wide open Pacific. As they drifted west at approximately 120 kilometers a day, the nearest landmass in their path was a single tiny blip on the map. Clipperton Island, a remnant of a Napolitan conquest, still under French rule, but a lonely outpost 1,600 kilometers west. To the south, the closest islands were the Galapagos, 1,770 kilometers distant on the other side of the equator. Alvarenga suddenly sensed that they were now in a completely different world.
That's absolute insanity. Like,
it's great. Like, they, like, I want the pictures of this to put this up just so I can show you. it tracks their movement kind of in the ocean. And you can kind of see like the distance that they're covered by like a little line, like, you know, day one, day three, day four, as it moves around. But it's not until you kind of pull back and realize that how small and insignificant these hundreds of kilometers these men were traveling in this vast ocean actually is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're just, and it's crazy. Like, it's insane. The sea was so calm, it was unnerving. The temperature soared well above 30 degrees Celsius, and the dry air teased the remaining moisture from their bodies. When Alvarenga swallowed, the spittle seemed to bump and rattle down his throat. He worried that his throat might swell and cut off access to his stomach. Was this the way he was going to die? Cordoba's lips were swollen to twice their normal size and sucked dry by the sun began to crack. Red welts caused by salt blocking up his sweat pores began to pop out along his arms and legs, breaking the layers of skin that were now shrunken and tight. Ugh. It felt like his skin would pop open and lay bare the muscles and tendons beneath. Lethargy laid siege to his normal functions.
Man, that is just...
It's really, really horrific, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, November 25th, 2012. So now we're 8 days in. As they drifted southwest, Alvarenga eyed the small triggerfish, 18 centimeters long, that had been chewing on his boat the night before. Known as sea piranhas, the triggerfish practically sanded the bottom of the boat clean with their teeth. Oh. He kneeled alongside the edge of the boat, eyes scanning for sharks, and shoved his arms into the water up to his shoulders. With his chest tightly pressed to the side of the boat, Alvarenga set a trap for the fish. He kept his hands steady, about 30 centimeters apart, and when a fish swam between them, he smashed them shut, digging his fingernails into the rough scales. Soon, he was able to capture as many as 30 of the small fish in a single session.
My God.
Now, this sounds like quite a lot, but these fish are... I took a look at these fish as well. They are very, very, very small fish. Yeah, they barely fit into your hand. Like,
so I was like, that's like a lot of work, like leaning over a boat.
Yeah.
You know, catching these small things with your bare hands, and you need to catch like a substantial amount just to have like...
Exactly.
Some sort of sustenance. Yeah. Like, yeah.
The men set up a mini fish processing plant on their boat. Alvarenga would snare them, and with the fishing knife... Cordoba expertly cleaned and sliced the fish into finger-sized strips that were left to dry in the sun. When Cordoba dumped the body innards of the palm-sized triggerfish into the water, it was rarely more than a few minutes before the mako and the blue sharks started feasting. The 1-meter-long sharks scraped their rough skin along the bottom of the boat, sending up a jolting blow and a noisy reminder of how little separated these two worlds. Like, that's terrifying in its own right.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and you you have to throw away all those like remnants, or else, yeah, like, obviously, you know, it'll start rotting up on board. But like, oh my God, every single time you do it, you're just like, you're basically just bringing those sharks along. They know to follow this boat because this boat
exactly
provides
it's food. Providing food for them. Yeah.
So like, you're just constantly guaranteeing that there's going to be sharks about, which is just not what you want.
Alvarenga began to drink his own urine. He wasn't embarrassed, and he encouraged Cordoba to follow suit. It was salty, but not revolting as he drank. Urinated, drank again, peed again, in a cycle that felt like it provided at least minimal hydration to his body. But urine, being filled with salts, throws the body's internal equilibriums off balance and requires the body to consume even more precious water in an attempt to flush out the salts. Mm. It was, both men realized, a desperate measure. December 10th, 2012, day 23. 1,480 kilometers off Mexico's coast. With their rainwater collection exhausted once more, a dehydrated Cordoba pleaded with Alvarenga, "Oranges, bring me oranges." Alvarenga stood above the prone man and assured him that food was close. "Okay, I'm going to the store. I will see if it's open to bring you some food," he said with conviction as he pointed to the horizon. "I will get tamales, oranges, and shrimp." Alvarenga strode with confidence for a few seconds it took to cross the length of the boat. After waiting for 5 minutes in silence, he strode back with bad news. "The store is closed, but don't worry. They open in an hour, and they will have fresh tortillas." To his surprise, the scheme seemed to work. Cordoba stopped moaning and fell asleep. The game of visiting the store brought Alvarenga a few hours' respite from the cloud of fear that had seized Cordoba's mind and rarely loosened its grip on the despairing young fisherman. He had begun to shrink, especially around his eyes, and Alvarenga couldn't avoid noticing the similarity between the skull and crossbones insignia stamped on the younger man's hoodie as his ever more bony face. Alvarenga's girth, too, was several sizes smaller, and his strength was ebbing away, but his mind still remained sharp. 15 years older, and a veteran of countless misadventures at sea, Alvarenga maintained an indefatigable will to survive. God. But ravaged by thirst and hunger, he recognized their collective health was slipping rapidly. Yet all around them, the sea teemed with life. Alvarenga felt he was in a cage where food was showcased tantalizingly just out of reach. Above their boat, the sky was dotted with the angular wings of gliding seabirds. On the horizon, fish chased by predators leapt out of the ocean. At sea level, islands of refuse washed by. Alvarenga, a skilled hunter on land, began to stalk the seabirds. Crouched like a flat soldier crawling through a battlefield, Alvarenga waited for a bird to land. When it first perched, the bird was attentive for several minutes, swinging its eyes, surveying the scene. Alvarenga didn't move. Instead, he waited until the bird's defenses relaxed. When the bird busied itself, eating fleas, lice, or whatever parasites lurked deep within its plumage, he inched across the deck of the boat, Alvarenga avoiding eye contact as he stalked its prey. When he crept closer, the bird snapped to attention, so Alvarenga froze again as the bird resumed preening. When his prey was within reach, Alvarenga slid his arm up the side of the boat, his fingers clenched in a fist, then he extended his fingers in slow motion, careful not to scrape the side of the boat. In a lightning instant, he had the bird's neck in one hand and the leg in another. Weary of stories that wild birds aim for the eyeball, Alvarenga kept the thrashing bird, which he called a duck, at arm's length until a short crack confirmed he had broken its neck. It's crazy. Like, he managed to catch basically a seabird that just perched on boat.
Well, he hung over a boat and caught, like, fish, and now he's, like, hunting birds. Like... he has no other option, but like, it's still pretty incredible.
You've got nothing else to do, you know. You have to try these things, you know.
I still feel like I would fail and mess it up 20 times over before you get any sort of success. This guy seems to know what he's doing.
An expert with a knife, Alvarenga felt like he was showing off as he cleaned the meager catch and laid out strips of glistening flesh. He added his only condiment, drops of seawater, onto strips warmed in the afternoon sun. He and Cordoba sat down to eat. Alvarenga popped a sashimi-sized chunk of raw duck, this is what he's calling it, into his mouth and chewed with gusto. Cordoba made a costly mistake. He smelled the seabird meat. Okay. Unlike his mate, who conjured gourmet flavors, Cordoba was revolted at the stench, like that of rotten fish. For 4 days, Alvarenga alternately threatened and cajoled the younger man to eat raw bird meat. Finally, the despondent mate took a tentative bite. Hunger had vanquished revulsion. Now in their fourth week adrift, the two men abandoned traditional modesty and walked naked, squatted on the rim of the boat next to the motor to defecate into the sea, then washed themselves with seawater. To pee, they stood and urinated into the ocean from roughly 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. They stood and urinated into the ocean. It's not an exact time in which they pee.
That's an exceeding length to pee, man. I know.
From roughly 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the men escaped the sun by living inside the icebox. It was crowded, stinky, uncomfortable, and painful to wedge two bodies into the box. But the men recognized that this inconvenience mattered little compared with the shelter it provided from the harsh sun. So imagine two of us trying to wedge ourselves into a chest freezer, D. That's wow.
You wouldn't care. Like, you wouldn't care when it's the only way to get out of the sun. Like,
wow.
You do it. You have to do it.
December 25th, 2012, day 36. Watching the moon grow bright, Alvarenga calculated Christmas was near. He diced four entire birds for their big meal. He had now learnt not to pluck the feathers, but to expertly peel the skin off the birds. A full bird, including the gut, provided as much meat as a hamburger, while salt water helped mask the stench. On the evening they estimated was Christmas Eve, as the men chattered, cleaning the birds and commenced their traditional meal. If there can be anything traditional about slicing, dicing and eating raw sea ducks, Cordoba coughed. My stomach, he groaned, as his eyes bulged like he was going to be sick. Bubbles and liquid dribbled from his mouth as a sudden, retching pain convulsed his body. Alvarenga handed him a half-liter bottle filled with rainwater, ignoring their rations. Cordoba sucked the bottle down and then spat it out. Whatever had taken a hold of his gut held tight and the pain intensified. The men dissected the intestines of Cordoba's duck and found a 15-centimeter articulated skeleton. The skin had fallen off and most of the meat was gone, but enough remained for the two of them to identify the remains of a venomous yellow-bellied sea snake.
Oh my god.
Chanka, there's a snake inside here, Cordoba explained. Yes, and you've already ate it, responded Alvarenga. Shit, I'm going to vomit, stuttered Cordoba. As he screamed and spewed white bubbles, Alvarenga wondered if the poison had entered his mate's bloodstream. Was it fatal? How did it kill its victims? Watching as a bubbly foam leaked out of his companion's mouth and listening to his guttural groans, Alvarenga considered his own fate. Had he also been poisoned? Alvarenga didn't get sick, and after 4 hours of retching and coughing, Cordoba stabilized. The men huddled, looking for subtle signs of improvement, aware the poison might have spread to other organs. The men tried to recall cases of bites by the yellow-bellied snake, but they had only heard third-hand versions, and their only firm conclusion was that even the most hardened fishermen gave the snake a wide berth and tried to decapitate it with a machete. The venom was not fatal, and Cordoba made a full physical recovery within 2 days. But in the realm of psychological terror, the poison possessed him. He retched at the thought of eating another seabird and withdrew from the world of food. Never again would he feast on one of Alvarenga's ducks. With 2 decades' experience at sea, Alvarenga was in an environment that felt like home. Cordoba was confused and lost. The back and forth swells and rocking were driving him mad. Could they just be still for a minute? When the waves were more than a meter high, and especially when the wind made them choppy, he began to vomit. It was a crude symptom of his overall psychological collapse. The two castaways were starting to veer off in different trajectories. So this younger guy, this inexperienced guy, it's really starting to take his toll on him now. Alvarenga, he has a bit more, obviously, sea experience. Like, but this other guy is really suffering.
This is basically like being in prison, like on a prison where, you know, you're exposed to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You have to catch, you know, vermin to eat.
Vermin, yeah.
You know, like it's just like that is pure hell. So, like, how long has it been? Like, you know, months at this point.
Like, yeah, it's just been a month, I think. Four weeks adrift.
Like, that's not like there's that. I wouldn't stay sane in that situation. Like this other guy, no. I guess just because of how much more experience he has with the sea and kind of the rocking isn't sending him mad. It's just a little bit easier on him, I suppose. Not easier, but like,
yeah.
I can't even fathom like
no
what you're experiencing, what's going like how you can cope with that situation.
Like it's the heat of the day and everything as well that would just drive you mad.
Oh, and the lack of water.
Not being able to do anything. Yeah, the lack of water, the lack of hydration, not being able to move, not being able to go anywhere. You're at mercy to the currents of the ocean, like, you know.
No, yeah, like it's worse. Like it's almost worse than death in ways because like you don't know, are you going to make it? Are you not? Yeah. What's the chance of being rescued? We don't know.
Yeah.
How long we're out here? We don't know. Like it's just, that's insane. Like
they may never drift into like a shipping lane, you know, they could just go in circles and eventually a storm take them or something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. You're just waiting for the next storm to knock you overboard or a shark or something, you know, or another, you eat some poisonous food and that's it. It does you in.
So March 1st, 2013, day 104 lost at sea, 4,180 kilometers off Mexico's coast. Even with a new stock of water, courtesy of a storm, and a more reliable food supply, Cordoba sank deeper into depression. Both men were now fully hydrated, but since the fatal dinner with the snake, Cordoba had maintained his steadfast refusal to eat raw birds. As he withered and shriveled, his arms began to look like sticks. His thighs were reduced to the size of a forearm. "Are you going to eat me?" Cordoba asked. Alvarenga joked that his mate was so emaciated that there was hardly any meat left. "And besides," said Alvarenga, "they had a stock of 3 live turtles, a small flock of bird, and dried strips of fish." To keep the captive birds from flying off, Alvarenga would break the bones in one wing. It was a cruel measure, but an essential part of his survival. Alvarenga's bird hunting techniques were now so effective he was eating a bird every day, sometimes two, and his weight had stabilized. Cordoba tolerated the occasional turtle meat and the fresh triggerfish, but there was never enough to slow his overall deterioration. Fear of food had become his new mantra. He asked Alvarenga to make a promise. "Don't eat me," he begged. "If I die, put my body up in the prow, tie me to the front of the boat." "Stop talking nonsense. No one is dying," Alvarenga replied, though he suspected this was no longer true. Cordoba imagined it was better to die in the ocean than to starve to death in the boat and concocted a kamikaze plan. He would wait for the shark pack to thicken and then jump into the water. When the sharks were gorging on the bird entrails, he moved near the edge of the boat. "Goodbye, Chanka," he said, and prepared to throw himself over the reel. Alvarenga grabbed the skinny young mate. They fought and wrestled, but Alvarenga overpowered Cordoba in a bear hug and dragged him back along the floor and stuffed him into the icebox. Cordoba began to bang and thrash, but the icebox alone weighed close to 50 kilograms, and with Alvarenga climbing atop, Cordoba found it impossible to tilt the box to one side and escape. "You need to stop thinking about killing yourself," Alvarenga yelled through its walls. When Cordoba calmed, Alvarenga slid off the top of the icebox, lifted the edge, and crawled inside. The two men talked. Alvarenga listened to Cordoba's arguments that their death was inevitable, and in response, he outlined a recovery plan. They just had to hold out to maintain reliable access to shade, water, and nourishment. "This is such a story, and we can tell it. We just have to fight to tell our story," argued Alvarenga. Cordoba's defiance resumed. He angrily demanded the opportunity to end his own life. When Alvarenga again restrained him inside the box, Cordoba began to beat his fists and his face and slam his head into the wall. Alvarenga watched his partner roll into a fetal ball, cry loudly, scream, yell, and then finally fell asleep. So this guy is really, really done. Like,
yeah, that's so such a sad thing to hear. Like,
yeah,
he's just really been absolutely ruined by this event.
So March 15th, 2013, day 118. "I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm almost gone," said Cordoba one morning before breakfast. "Don't think about that. Let's take a nap," said Alvarenga as he lay alongside Cordoba. "I am tired. I want water," Cordoba moaned. His breath was rough. Alvarenga retrieved the water bottle and put it to Cordoba's mouth, but his mate did not swallow. Instead, he stretched out. His body shook in short convulsions. He groaned and his body tensed up. "Don't die," said Alvarenga, who suddenly panicked. He screamed into Cordoba's face. "Don't leave me alone. You have to fight for life. What am I going to do here alone?" Cordoba didn't reply. Moments later, he died with his eyes open. "I propped him up on a bench to keep him out of the water," said Alvarenga. "I was afraid a wave might wash him out of the boat. I cried for hours." Alvarenga awoke the next morning, climbed out of the icebox, and stared at Cordoba in the bow of the boat, sitting on the bench like a sunbather. Alvarenga queried the corpse. "How do you feel? How was your sleep?" Alvarenga answered his own questions aloud as if it was Cordoba speaking from the afterlife. "I already ate. And you?" continued Alvarenga, talking to Cordoba. "Me too," he answered, as if he was Cordoba. "I ate in the kingdom of heaven." The conversation continued as if they were two chatty mates eating a leisurely breakfast. Alvarenga decided the easiest way to deal with losing his only companion was to simply pretend he hadn't died. Throughout the day, Alvarenga treated the corpse like a friend to whom he could share fears, thoughts, and stream of consciousness stories. "Why don't we go to Tonala, the Mexican city where fishermen from the region regularly partied, have some beers, a great dinner? First, I think I'll take a shower. I have my clothes ironed and ready to go. I have good shoes, too." On the second day after death, Cordoba's body turned purple as the conversations unfolded. During day three, his skin began to cook in the sun. Like dry leather, it developed a crusty edge. I touched him and he was solid, said Alvarenga. He never smelled, he just dried up in the sun. It did not disgust me at all. It seemed normal, and I hugged him. By the fourth day, Cordoba was nearly black, and Alvarenga had fully incorporated the corpse into his daily routines, bidding it buenos dias, buenas tardes, and buenas noches. Then Alvarenga began to sing hymns to the corpse. He was certain Cordoba was listening and watched intently to see if the body moved. How is death? Alvarenga asked. I want to know, my friend. Is it painful? Death is beautiful, and I am waiting for you, Alvarenga answered, as if Cordoba was speaking aloud to him. I don't want to go, retorted Alvarenga. I am not headed that way. The soliloquy with the corpse wreaked havoc on Alvarenga's sanity. He started to go mad. He couldn't imagine surviving alone in the boat. Despite their fundamental character differences, the men worked as a team, hunted together, suffered for months, and shared a common fate. Maybe death was not such a dark path, Alvarenga thought as he spent hours staring at his dead mate. 6 days after Cordoba's death, Alvarenga sat with the body on a moonless night in full conversation with the mummified corpse when, as if waking from a dream, he was suddenly shocked to find he was conversing with the dead. I tried to throw his body into the ocean, but I couldn't. Later in the evening, I tried again. First, I washed his feet. His clothes were useful, so I stripped off a pair of shorts and sweatshirt. I put that on. It was red with a little skull and crossbones, and then I dumped him in. And as I slid him into the water, I fainted.
So, wait. He fainted?
Yes. Alvarenga himself fainted when he pushed his dead friend.
Okay, I gotcha. I thought maybe he fell into the water or something.
No.
Man, that's incredibly sad.
Yeah.
The whole little... Obviously,
that whole,
dying
that whole rundown, yeah.
He lost, like, his only friend for the last 100-odd days, like, his only company. Yeah, heartbreaking stuff, especially him like chatting away at him, you know, as if nothing had happened, kind of just like as a coping thing.
Absolutely, I know. And the fact that it was almost, when I read this, it was almost like, do you remember in the movie Castaway, when Tom Hanks is just talking to the Wilson, this inanimate object, you know?
It's exactly like that. Yeah,
that's exactly it. Like, it's just that company, you know. Which is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. One second. On January 30th, 2014, 14 months after his disappearance and 8,850 kilometers from his point of origin, Alvarenga washed ashore on Ebon Atoll in the Marshall Islands. He was treated at a hospital before being flown to El Salvador, where he was reunited with his ecstatic parents and daughter. Some people doubted that his extraordinary tale of survival could be true, but the testimonies of the doctors who examined him and of oceanographers who plotted the journey he took, taking into account prevailing winds and currents, were overwhelmingly in support of him. In 2014, Alvarenga's lawyer announced that his client had passed a lie detector test. So,
that's incredible. All these people just doubted him, like...
That's as far as that kind of account goes. So I did a bit more digging into what actually went on, and it turns out that whenever the reactions, obviously, of people, obviously his family were overwhelmed with him being found, and a lot of people were. He spent 11 days in hospital until he was deemed healthy enough to return. He did have a lot of trouble. He was diagnosed with anemia and had trouble sleeping and developed an extreme fear of water. And in 2015, he gave a series of interviews, one of which is where that previous piece I read came from, about his ordeal, who published his story as a book. And the book was called 438 Days, An Extraordinary True Survival Story of Survival at Sea. However, shortly after the release of the book, the family of Cordoba sued Alvarenga for $1 million. And their suing him kind of came on the part of, they accused him of cannibalism. in order to survive. They didn't believe that he survived purely on birds, on turtles. And they believe that he would have kept the body, because the two were close, and they believe that he would have kept the body no matter what, until obviously he washed up or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's where his story, when he says, you know, he slid the body in and he fainted, it was kind of, wasn't met. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of almost like, that's convenient. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't know. Yeah, what happened to his body? Blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that Cordoba would not have been eaten after death, Alvarenga's lawyer obviously denied the accusation. And then in 2014, he took the lie detector test, which he passed. But a lot of people then criticized lie detector tests.
And, oh, yeah. Like they're not scientific, really. Like, it's more... It only gives you sort of an idea, doesn't it? Like the lie detector test. Yeah. Like there's ways to fake it and stuff. But like, yeah, I don't know. Like, should you necessarily, like, you probably should give him the benefit of the doubt, I suppose.
I think so.
I don't see why, I think it's perfectly reasonable that he wouldn't keep the body the whole time, especially for 400 days. Because like that's it. At that point, it would have like degraded like massively anyway. So like, I don't really understand.
He also said that for 4 days after Cordoba's death, he contemplated suicide, but it was his strong Christian faith that ultimately prevented him from doing so. Alvarenga claims that Cordoba made him promise not to eat his corpse when he died, so he wanted to honor that promise he made to his friend. And after 6 days, after his descent into insanity, that's when he threw the corpse overboard. He also stated that while at sea, he frequently dreamt about his favorite foods as well as his parents. He claimed to have seen numerous transoceanic container ships while drifting alone, but was unable to solicit help. He kept track of time by counting the phases of the moon. After counting his 15th lunar cycle, he spotted land, a tiny desolate islet, which turned out to be a remote corner of the Marshall Islands. And on the 30th of January, he abandoned his boat and swam to shore, where he stumbled up the beach and found a beach house owned by a local couple.
My God.
The length of his voyage had been calculated as 5,500 to 6,700 miles, or 8,900 to 10,800 kilometers. That's how much he drifted around.
That's insane.
Now, he was only ever 4,000 kilometers off the coast, if that makes sense, of Mexico, but only, he managed to drift. I know, but he managed to drift another, like, up to 10,000 kilometers.
That's insane.
Though some newspapers originally claimed that Alvarenga had been at sea for 16 months, he never said to himself. The newspapers eventually corrected their error and shortened his voyage to 13 months, according to G. Bing, Marshall Islands' acting Secretary of Foreign Affairs. Alvarenga's vital signs were all good, with the exception of blood pressure, which was unusually low. Bing also stated that Alvarenga had swollen ankles and struggled with walking. On the 6th of February, the doctor treating him reported that his health had gone dramatically downhill, and that he was also on an IV drip to treat his dehydration. He recovered well, and he now still lives in Mexico.
That's incredible.
It's crazy. He survived over a year floating on sea. And it's unbelievable, because when you see like the little point, like when you see the map and you see the point of where he was, like the land looks so close. Like Mexico looks so close. And actually Australia even looks close to where he is. You know, he's kind of between that Australia and Mexico, like that branch of water. And he just kind of floated around in like a little circle.
Yeah.
And that's all that happened. He just never found...
He was totally at the whim of like the currents and the breeze and stuff like that.
It.
Like he had no way
to
move himself. Even like that's crazy. Like at the end when he found an island, like he had to abandon his boat. Like that's... Because his boat didn't wash up on shore, he had to actually abandon it.
He had to abandon and swim for the island.
That's a pretty big
ballsy
risk.
Move.
Yeah, like, yeah. You know, because there's nothing there. That island is just empty. Now you're stranded on an island.
And you could be so fatigued that you might not even make it to the island.
Yeah,
you could drown.
That's
weird. You know? It's an incredible story. And I remember reading about it years ago and hearing that there was so much backlash at the time because people just believed this whole cannibal thing. And then Secondly, they said that he was on an island and he fabricated this whole story about being lost on a boat. They believe that him and one of the theories was him and his friend had a disagreement. He killed the friend, swam to an island, dumped the friend, swam to an island and hid there for like whatever 13 months and then washed ashore and said that he, you know, fabricated this story in order to get away with this murder.
All right.
Which I guess we will never know the full story, but I mean, it's a great, that would be extreme measures to go to.
Oh, yeah.
To starve yourself and, yeah.
And come back, like, dehydrated and, like, your body all fucked up. Like, I don't think, I think there's, particularly, like, because we covered this a couple weeks ago with the cartels and stuff in Mexico, like, like there were mass graves in Mexico where I just don't think a person would go to these extreme lengths to get away with murder, like whenever there's mass murders that occur in that country.
It's a crazy story, but it's a good one.
It's an incredible story, like absolutely incredible.
If you Google him, you can actually see videos of like when he sets foot back onto land from the boat when he's taken up onto the port. It's really, really cool. It's really nice to see. It was on the news. It was all over the news at 1.2, obviously. I remember seeing it in like BBC News years ago. Never thought anything of it because we just didn't hear these stories. But yeah, good story. Great survival story. And another fantastic human feat, I think, for our series, dude.
Absolutely. 400 days at sea. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Hope you enjoyed that one.
I did indeed. It was a very good story. We'll make an excellent movie. Excellent book. Might pick up the book.
The book is there. Right, I think that all it is left to do is we have a community question and then we can wrap up this week's episode, Dave. What do you think?
Woo! Community question.
Yes, so this week we have a community question because I forgot to post it until late last night. Apologies. But we'll do the rollover to next week with all the rest of your community questions. But this week it comes from Live Berries, got in touch to say, how did the name Empty Promise Podcast come about? Were there any other front runner names or has it always been Empty Promise?
Well, it has not always been Empty Promise.
No.
We began as XX Gaming.
That's right.
We're a couple of gamer guys, play Xbox.
We started the podcast as Excite Gaming.
We were a gaming
to talk about games.
Focused, not a podcast, gaming focused YouTube channel, which I mean never took off.
No, we just it was just a lot of effort. Really, we just didn't want to. We couldn't dedicate that kind of time.
The only thing we
wanted to make videos and stuff.
The only thing we did dedicate time to was the podcast that we did, which was meant to be a gaming podcast. It was called XX Gaming Podcast. And then whenever we realized that we hadn't done any games in like a year, and our podcasts were normally not about games, we were like, we should not be called gaming because no one who listens is interested in the gaming stuff, and we don't talk about gaming stuff, so.
We also had a line when we opened our shows, the podcast shows. It was welcome to the, if you go back, you can listen to the original shows, you'll hear it. And it was welcome to the Excite Gaming Podcast. Will you come for the games, but stay for the truth? And then it was home of the empty promise.
Yeah.
Because we were always promising things that we just never delivered on. And so we came up with home of the empty promise. And I think somewhere maybe empty promise might have stuck from there.
I think because we were like, we're going to rebrand. And like, you know, we have about 1,000 rebrand names.
Right, I wanted to bring that up. Yeah, we have so many rebrands.
But at the
time, we love a good rebrand.
At the time, we were like, what are we calling ourselves? And then it was just like, what about, we're the home of the Empty Promise podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense because we already said.
Why don't we just, it was basically just a case of steering into the skid. It was already there for us.
Pretty much, yeah. Like,
let's just steer into it. No, there was never any other front runners, I don't think. And there was never anything else we really wanted to do. Although I'm glad that we did steer away from gaming as such, because I don't think I would have been able to maintain just a true gaming podcast this long. I can talk about games and I enjoy playing games, but I definitely couldn't have kept it going.
It's a different thing talking
years.
About like game news and the game industry and stuff. Like, it's hard to keep an interest in that. But like, I think as
there
well,
there are fantastic podcasts that cover that kind of stuff, and I'd be happy to recommend any of them. But
exactly, this is not us. We're home of the empty promise. We don't have the dedication and the kind of stick with itness.
No, we enjoy. We basically just enjoy talking about things that we enjoy, that we find interesting. Yeah, and if other people find that interesting, which clearly hundreds of people seem to do, then that's what we'll continue to bring.
Good on you. I think Empty Promise as well kind of encapsulates what we do in that.
Oh yeah,
come join our live podcast at 11 o'clock on Saturday. 11:45 we'll be there, you know.
Yeah, we're gonna have a top rated guest this week. 6 months later, our first guest.
Yes, exactly.
Comes onto the podcast.
Guest hasn't been on yet.
No,
don't worry about it.
This is just what we do, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a tri-weekly podcast. I think you put it down as where we try to have it done on a weekly basis.
Yeah. We actually have been consistent as all hell at them, like recently.
We've been very good. Weekly basis, we've been very good. Yep, this is very nice. Just through the medium of Zoom, which is not our, it wouldn't be our top pick for doing this. It's always nice to kind of have that back and forth around the table. And it's a lot easier to bring in guests, and it's so much easier when it comes to editing, just to have one kind of file to work with. But we will get back to that. We will get back to that. Better days are coming. But thank you for the question. Really appreciate it. And we will take other... We'll take all the rest of the questions and pop them next week.
We'll take your questions at the end, please. Thank you very much.
Please hold all thumbs to the end.
Yes.
D, person with the podcast, what do you want to talk about? What do you get up to this week?
Well, one thing that I did not do this week, and because you touched on it earlier, Pancake Tuesday.
Yeah.
Nary a pancake was had in this house on Pancake Tuesday, no.
I was sure in my head I was thinking D's got to enjoy some pancakes this week.
I completely forgot Pancake Tuesday. I just completely forgot all of it.
Yeah.
Was not aware.
It's a different year, D.
It's a very different year, Chris. Very different year. Yeah. Is it always this early? Is it always in February? Like
no. I mean I hear a lot of people saying Easter's early this year, which can only mean that the Lenten period starts earlier as well. So,
is Easter, like, I only ever hear that Easter's early this
year. Easter's early, yeah, I know. Like, last year, Easter was early and it fell on like the 12th of April. This year, it's early and it falls on like the 4th of April. So, next year, it's probably going to fall in March. We'll literally be coming out of Christmas and going, God, it's Pancake Tuesday next week, you know?
Early Easter this year.
Wednesday.
Bye.
Yeah. No, apparently it's early this year, so whatever that means. Have you made any, as I like to call them, quarter year, I forget the name of them. I don't like to call them this at all.
I was
trying to do something there, didn't have resolutions. You know, people do things for Lent. Are you doing anything?
No. Well, I didn't know it was Lent, Chris, so I missed the boat on that, but I did.
Maybe you're drinking more Dr. Pepper.
No. That's Dr. Pepper, if anything. But I think I've got to start eating healthier again. Better.
Because
I did... You know the way you do, like, over Christmas? You're like, all right, we can take out now. Like, it's... Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Haven't stopped that yet. And it's now February. It's now March, basically, so...
That's a good thing, man. That's a good thing.
The days are getting longer. You're sort of getting into that more like, I would start, you know, going outside and, you know, interacting with the world and not...
Getting a walk.
Exactly.
Not
sitting inside eating junk food all the time, so... That'll be probably the next while we're going to be working on that.
Good. That's a great thing to do, man. Absolutely.
It's got to be done. But
it's good. You've got to look after the health, you know.
Aside from that, man, like, it's been...
I hope in your new house you're going to put in a little home gym. I want that to be a thing.
Part of me is like, that would be nice. The other part of me is like, I don't know if I'd utilize it to its fullest extent. I think I would probably put, like, I think one thing I would definitely like is like a treadmill or an exercise bike.
Yes. Great.
And that would probably be it, you know. In terms of things I'd actually utilize, that would probably be it.
Get yourself a little set of dumbbells as well. You can do a lot. Or a kettlebell. You can do a lot with just a single kettlebell.
Okay, I can also leave it sitting in the corner.
Mm-hmm. It could be used to prop open a door.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
papers you blowing away in the breeze. Not anymore.
Yeah, crack your tone at once or twice a year and curse it in and out of hell.
Yeah,
till it eventually winds up on Gumtree like so many others.
We'll see, Chris. The biggest priority in the new house is going to be the podcast setup. You know.
Oh man,
I'm so
looking forward to seeing this. Like, yeah, it's going to be so fucking cool.
Probably never happen. Home only empty.
No, it will happen. It will happen because I'll have to come down and we can use your single kettlebell, get a good heavy workout in, then order a good pizza and then sit down in this dedicated.
It's gonna be like a Tomb Raider Angel of Darkness. We gotta go lift some kettlebells so we're strong enough to set up the rest of the studio.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. Strong enough to use our voices for over an hour at a time.
Oh yeah, you know where it comes from, the voice. From your arms, so that's what you really want to work on, you know.
Yeah, it does indeed.
You gotta go. I got there.
And that's a factoid. Yeah. Anything else you get up to this week?
Not really. No. Started watching. No, didn't start watching. Continued watching Dark on Netflix. It's a German program.
Dark. Oh.
But it's very different. It's like the second season is really picked up for me. I'm really enjoying it now. But heavy Lost vibes, Chris.
Ooh,
very Lost-esque in places. Other places not so much, but in some places you're like, oh yeah, now I'm feeling it. They like to leave you with a question. Yeah, they like to leave you with a question at the end of an episode.
I do like a show that does that. Like,
And like, I think that's kind of it. I haven't really been playing games. Minecraft, unfortunately, has died a death in my life. I haven't went back to it. And really, games in general, I haven't really been playing. I've been thinking about. I haven't actually got it yet, but I've purchased my next book. Ooh, exciting!
Now, what is it, D? What is it? Are you going to keep it secret till it comes?
No. I just remember the name of it. I know the concept. I was like, The Last Day, it's called. Andrew Hunter Murray, who actually is on a podcast called No Such Thing as a Fish, which is a good podcast I listen to.
Yeah.
And apparently it's about if the world stopped spinning, how we survive. And it's a story set in a world where the earth has stopped spinning. I always thought that's such a cool concept. It's like, there's no day, like day and night happens.
Cycles wouldn't, yeah.
It happens over the course of a year. You know what I mean? Wow. So like, yeah, I think that's really cool. And like there's this like point on like there's this line where day meets night. There's like a twilight zone essentially, which is like the only place you can live because night is too cold and day is too warm. And people are like, I think it's good.
That's a great
I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to a review of that because that's something I think I would also enjoy.
So that's it kind of
it always seems to be a quiet week at the minute.
Well, there's not, we can't do much, can we, you know?
No, well that's it. I'm the exact same. Toyed about with some new food recipes this week, which was nice, courtesy of my sister. Went in some big runs, read some more books, played some more Tomb Raider, and that's it, man.
That's a wrap. You drizzled some Batafil? What the hell do you call that? Bacafil? No. Bacafoil? That's tinfoil.
Bacafoil is
Biscafoil? Biscafon?
Oh, Biscoff.
Biscoff. Yeah. You drizzled some Biscoff on your pancakes? Yeah, very good.
I did. Yeah, it was very, very good. Yeah. I'll send you a picture of it after.
Please do.
Yeah, that's it, man. Yeah, it was a quiet week. Although there's always something and I'm like, I need to mention this to D. And then I just forget.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's standard. Did you make any Lenten vows?
So myself and my brother are currently trying to do, for the first week in Lent, 200 push-ups a day.
For the first week of Lent?
Yeah, because then it'll go up by 50 to 100 every week after that. Purely for bragging rights. That is the only reason behind this. We're waiting for the first one of us to fail for a day, and then we can both quit and say that the other person went further. Yeah. That's it.
Of course.
But so far, we're like 3-4 days in or something, and we're both knocking them out. That's it. That's the only problem. Oh, I also said I was going to go off swearing, which every year I make that promise, and every year I try a little bit harder. It doesn't always work out. In fact, it never has. It just seems to be part of my vernacular, and it creeps in on everything I say. And but I'm trying hard that when I feel like a swear word coming on, to pause, think about it, and go the opposite way.
I get you.
I think it's causing more damage to my health.
You're getting like you're gonna come out in hives next because you're suppressing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But that's one for me. Like, I've lost the value in it. Like, I don't see... When I swear, typically, it's like when I'm talking with a friend or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, low pressure. Yeah. And I don't do it in the podcast much, but when I do, it's normally when I'm like, kind of just slips out because I've said
that's
a lot.
It. Yeah.
So,
yeah,
like, I know, yeah, like, in work and stuff, I have a different... You know, you have different tones of voice, different ways of speaking, depending on who you're speaking to. It's kind of eliminated from there, so I don't really worry about it slipping out in a professional capacity. Mm-hmm. So, like, for me, I don't really care. Although the one thing I have a problem with is whenever I'm at home and the kids are about, it slips out a lot then, and I'm like, I probably shouldn't have done that.
It's a strange thing, Dee, because if I go somewhere, or if I'm out with someone, or I'm in a setting with people that I'm not familiar with, I have no problem reeling my tongue in. Mm-hmm. Like, I can talk the best without even uttering a swear. Say I walk downstairs into the kitchen and I'm doing something, and it'll just slip out in casual vocabulary, like it would with us on the podcast. Yeah. And I'm like, why did I say that? In the gym, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh my goodness. Even when I'm out running, like I'm talking and I'm swearing in my conversation. I'm like, why? Like, this just doesn't have to. It's just a bad habit. That's all it is.
That's,
and it's just about kicking the habit.
Not true.
Really?
About it being a bad habit. There is...
Oh.
I don't know if you've watched The History of Swear Words. I haven't watched it. But I remember when it came out, there was like an article in relation to it talking about the benefits of swearing, about being
okay.
And there's a couple of different like ways. One is like what do you call that whenever you do something like kind of aggressive to relieve stress and stuff like that? It's got there's a word for it,
just a release, like
there's a word I can't think of it. People are probably who are listening to this point probably know exactly what it is.
It's like
cathartic.
A purge?
It's cathartic.
Oh, cathartic. Okay.
So, like, you know, you can actually relieve stress by swearing and yelling and stuff like that. You know, like screaming. Sometimes people do that to try and relieve stress.
I'm ugly and I'm proud.
But it has that, and it also has like a real like social benefit as well, because as we've kind of mentioned, like when you're speaking with certain people, you feel comfortable enough to swear.
Comfortable enough with your best friends to go for a dump in their house. That's how you know they're your best friends.
That's it. That's the factor. You have to meet that criteria.
If you can't dump in someone's house, you're not that close with them. Fact.
Oh no. When I go to your house, I frequently come to your house just to take a dump. And I'll hop in the shower quickly afterwards.
Just hop in the shower and dump there.
Yeah.
Kill two birds with one stone.
But the other thing about it is It's like you're in on a secret, right? Whenever two people can swear to each other, it's like we're both doing it, you know? It's kind of like we're both doing the taboo thing, so it's like...
It's naughty.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, but we're, you know, it's fine for us to do it, right? You know, it's like we're both mm-hmm. doing it, yeah. Oh, we're swearing, yeah, like, yeah, yeah, we can just do it, me and you. It's no big deal, because we're tight, you know?
Yeah.
There's that element to it.
I get it,
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... And there's a swear language. Every language in the world that's known has swears. A swear word, you know?
Okay.
So
why did
that happen, you know?
It's right enough.
Some benefit to it.
Every language has it. It just has a way. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. So it's not just a bad habit. Okay.
Yeah.
That's something I actually want to borrow off you is, you know, is it James Clear wrote the book Atomic Habits?
Oh yeah.
Now, I've listened to the audiobook and I enjoyed it, but I think I'd benefit more from actually reading the words. And I think you have the book.
I have it on tape. No, I have it. Kindle.
Have audio.
I have Kindle.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I can't. I don't know if I can share that with you or how that works.
I'll buy the book. I'll buy it. It's something I'd like to have. But yeah, they were my only to-dos, I guess, for this Lenten period.
Do you remember in primary school, Chris, we were always told, don't go off something for Lent. Go on something. Try going on
go
something
on
for Lent.
Go on telling someone that you love them
every
day.
I'm going to go on.
You should do that anyway. You
know? I'm going to go on eating better foods. Instead of going off eating bad foods, I'm going to go on eating better foods. There you go.
But that's, do you know, spin. Again, that's a much better way to look at it. You're more likely to succeed in developing a healthier habit by saying that you're not restricting yourself from certain foods, that you're eating a certain way because you want to, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, I can't have these crisps, if you say, I don't want to have these crisps, you're much more likely to stick at that regime of not eating the crisps.
But I want the crisps, Chris.
Of course, if you're like us or like me and you say, I want the crisps, you'll just eat the crisps. In fact, you may eat 2 packs of the crisps.
I'm 3 packs deep and I'm like, I don't want the crisps anymore.
I didn't want these crisps. Why are you doing this crisps? Yeah, I get it. No, that's it, lad. I'll let you know how it goes in the next chapter in next week's episode.
Yeah.
But that's it. And I think that's everything from this week's podcast, if you're happy enough.
I want everyone who's listened this far, let us know in the comments what you're going on or off for Lent, or if you do Lent at all. And if not,
yeah,
do go on something, not for Lent, but just for you. Do that.
Maybe you could go on listening to podcasts. Oh, yeah. I know a great one you could start with.
You could go on leaving reviews on podcasts. And if you haven't done that before, you can try to test it below.
Imagine that discussion around the water cooler at work. So you doing anything for Lent? I'm actually going on something. Oh, what are you going on? Like healthy food, dieting, exercise? No, I'm going on leaving reviews on podcasts.
How many podcasts have you listened to and not left a review? For me, it's tons, so... Maybe that is something I'm going to
go on. I think
I've
only ever left a review on one podcast.
We have to practice what we preach. We're like, can you still leave a review down below? True. We're like, we've never done it. I'm going to go on it this week. I'm going to leave reviews on podcasts. That's it.
I'm going to leave a review on our podcast.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that'll show them. A one-star one as well. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, thank you for finding this podcast. We hope it has found you well. Remember, the audio version is available on any podcast hosting service. Just search for Empty Promise Podcast, and you can do the same thing over at youtube.com. If you want the video version, just search for Empty Promise Podcast. Find us on social media, again, using the handle Empty Promise Podcast, and you can get in touch with us there or through our email address, which is the
emptypromisepodcast@gmail.com. That is our business email, Chris. That's what that is. That's for all business email. Contacts, sponsorship deals, etc., contact us through that email. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for finding us and for the questions, for everything. We're so very, very grateful wherever you find us. Spain last week was our top city. Spain.
Spain, the city? Spain?
No, Madrid was our top city. Madrid. Spain was our top country.
That's where I'm from. Spain city.
So,
Portugal.
Hola and gracias.
Yeah. Que pase?
That's all I know.
I don't know.
Que pase? Mi pase? Me pase es su pasa. Don't know what I've just said.
Biblioteca.
I hope. La biblioteca. I have no idea. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, thank you so much. We'll see you all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed next week. Goodbye and God bless.
Bye-bye.